Welcome, Todd, to the Picture House podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on today. It's always an event when we have a Todd Haynes film. It's nice we haven't had to wait too long since the last one.
Yeah, things have been picking up a little bit since I started to work with writers and scripts that are out there. Mm. But it's been such a great sort of new phase of my career to do so since Carol, I guess.
Carol was a huge for us, and I think we did we had a 35mm print, and
yeah,
you know, it became a bit of an event film.
Exactly. Yeah, and that print gets shown, or there's two prints in existence.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Struck from the DI, but the film was shot in 60mm. And there's one in the States, and it gets shown regularly at Metrograph around Christmas time. It's become a sort of Christmas film in the States, which I love, which I never would have expected.
I was going to say, actually, this Christmas, I saw a lot of our rep cinemas were showing Carol alongside Elf, The Holiday. You know,
surreal,
it's become
that
a Christmas
movie.
Surreal.
That is so funny.
It must be nicer when you discover, you know, a movie actually has, it's taken on life of its own.
Yeah.
You know, it's out there, it's doing its thing.
Yeah. It is. And it's funny about my body of work is that different films sort of generate discrete audiences for that one film often, which is a little bit unusual, I guess. You know, like there's that, and when I have public appearances or whatever, I can sort of tell that some people are going to come down at the end and they're going to be the Velvet Underground, Velvet Gold Mine audience. And I'm doing a Velvet Underground documentary now, which is why it's a hard one to separate. Or the Dylan fans are going to be for I'm Not There or Far From Heaven. It's funny. It must really
be quite nice. And also just a fun game to play.
Like, yeah.
Okay, you're the Poison fans.
Exactly.
the early birds.
Yes. Karen Carpenter. Ah, okay.
At what point did this film come into your life? Was it something that you were aware of whilst you were working on the last film? Was it sort of... Because the turnaround time is so quick.
It is, especially since there were other things in development that were happening before this film... before I was able to make a commitment to this film. Because I first heard about it in 2017, and I had some things in the way, at least for the window of opportunity that the opening that Mark had to he wanted to shoot it. There was an amazing sense and a really reasonable sense of urgency about getting this film made that was coming even more than from Mark, from participant media. Mm. And this just doesn't happen. Like that a studio wants to get a film out for all the right reasons, you know, because of its social relevance and because we're heading into an election year this year. So there was this sort of healthy but unique sense of urgency about getting it out. And I appreciated it, and Mark appreciated it. But there were times where we looked at each other like, is this happening too fast, you know? Because every movie takes time, and this is a complicated story with a complicated history. And a lot of research that was required, and the New York Times article had only broken in 2016.
Wow!
And by 2017, there was a first draft, and by 2018, we were in pre-production for the film.
That's very speedy.
It really is.
And that's the thing when you're watching it, because the film is full of, you know, rich history and lots of historical detail.
Yeah,
it looks like you have to spend years prepping something like this with all of the information that's contained in this film.
I mean, the person who was spending years prepping all the information, of course, was Rob Ballot. Mm. And so we inherited his unbelievable, laborious history that he was piecing together. And then Nathaniel Rich fashioned into a news piece in the Times that's really kicked the whole thing forward. But it really took really talented screenwriters to sort of ingest all of that and to find a way to tell it in a dramatic fashion that kept an audience in suspense, but also emotionally invested in a story like this.
I think that's the treat of this is it's accessible. And people will watch it because it's actually great entertainment.
Yeah.
But you can't help but go home and, like we're saying, with the water that we're drinking right now, you know, you just you think about it, it stays with you.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear that has that kind of effect on people. I mean, I think it reminded me of movies that I've always loved that I'd never had taken a crack at myself as a director, starting with the fantastic sort of post-Watergate you know, paranoia films of Alan Pakula that Gordon Willis shot, like All the President's Men, and following decades later with Silkwood or Michael Mann's amazing The Insider from the 90s. But they're films that alert you to the social issues that the characters are disclosing, but they also hang with you and leave a sense of disquiet, you know, that you take home and that you look at systems of power and you look at the culture that we live in a different way afterwards.
I think that's the best way to get across, you know, something that is based on a serious real life case. If the audience can experience it, they can go on a journey, a thrilling journey, like they get with Dark Waters and those films you mentioned.
Yeah.
They're engrossing. They're exciting films.
Exactly.
But they do, they resonate with people.
They resonate with you. And you really, and they really do change the way you think. And they do change the way you feel. And that was the inspiration for this movie.
I think when I see something like Dark Waters, like I say, it's so full of information, but also it's got the genre beats. You know, like it steps up a notch and it is exciting.
Yeah. That's so great to hear. What's so funny is that the genre beats you describe, you know, and I can think of some in my head. I'm not sure which ones you're thinking of, but they all come from something that really happened. Mm. And that's so gratifying to feel like we weren't inventing it or laying it on or glossing over the truth. It really was coming out of the experience that Rob described to us firsthand.
And it just gives you an insight into his life over the last few years, like living with this.
Oh, yeah.
A sense of, an
encroaching sense of peril and loneliness, particularly in that last act where he's wading through that 7-year process of the outcome of that science panel and helpless, you know, and not getting any information and just hearing from members of that very massive class action who are getting sicker and dying, you know, and being utterly uncertain as to whether the risk that they took in giving, because if they found no links between PFOA and any human illness, DuPont would be off the hook in perpetuity, and the curtain would close again on this story. So they had risked that much by agreeing to those terms. And so it was really an either-or situation. And, of course, the outcome was the one we wanted, and it established links to 6 serious illnesses. It's good news, but it's also, like, the saddest and most devastating good news.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the whole time when you're watching the film, you're sort of, you can't cheer too much because there's this underlying consequence.
Exactly.
And like you say, that sort of, you have that ticking clock sort of, you know, in the third act when they have to get everything sorted in time.
Yeah.
Like you just can't believe this is what people actually had to go through to get the social justice that they need.
I know. And to think that if it were not for a Rob Ballot and the sort of series of accidental events that lined up to bring the story to his doorstep, you know, or that there was a medical monitoring ruling in West Virginia, of all states in the country, that he could use to make actionable against the corporate practices like this. You know, these are just flukes that just happen to line up. And if all those things hadn't been the case, or if it wasn't a corporate defense attorney who had the sort of, you know, the overhead of a well-financed firm behind him that was willing to put its reputation on the line, you know, all of these things, this story simply would not have come out.
I think that's, again, it adds to the cinematic nature of it.
Yeah.
When it's the, you know, if it wasn't for this one thing, if it wasn't for this ad, if it wasn't for that ruling or for that person, the persistent people to push us forward.
It's personality, it's accidents of fate and time. And yes, that's inherently dramatic, you know, and you wonder at and are spellbound by the fact that those things all existed.
When you're working on a film like this and you have a real life person, you have a Rob Ballot, how do you like to work with that person to do their story justice?
Well, the whole, my God, I just think we have all fallen in love with Rob. and everything that one reads about Rob, from the Nathaniel Rich piece that was my first, you know, entree to the story, described him as this sort of formidable character who's, you know that he's under, to describe him as understated as an understatement, and you know, and that he's very hard to reach and he's very hard to break through to. And I have to say, from the very first meeting that I had with Rob in May of 2018, when I went out to Cincinnati with Mario Correa, the writer I brought on, I just found somebody so easy to be with. So honest and sort of and bravely, touchingly open about what he went through and how hard it was at times. And that was true for Sarah, his wife. And they must have felt, and I guess I hear him say this now, some trust that we were there for the right reasons, and that he felt Mark Ruffalo and myself and Mario and participant that we were going to tell this story fairly, you know, and that we had an honest intent, because it's the only way I can explain how forthcoming he was and how much he put us at ease in the process.
It must have been quite bemusing for him, like he's been living this for so long, and then you know, big film stars are coming in to play him and to tell his story to such a big audience.
I mean, when he said to Mario and I on that trip, he said, when the New York Times story came out, I knew they couldn't kill me. You know, and then you just shudder. There just lands inside you as you hear that, and you realize, holy shit, this really is... this is the real deal. This is it, you know? And then, of course, yes, now a major motion picture is coming to tell the story to an even broader audience and maybe in a way that will reach even more people. And you feel like, okay, I'm playing a small part in this unburdening of what he's been carrying alone for so many years. And it's funny, we watched Rob lighten and sort of uncoil while being around him during the shoot, you know, and it was so while Mark was doing everything he could to kind of turn into Rob and represent the burden that he depict the burden that Rob was taking physically and emotionally and really portray somebody very unlike himself. It was so interesting to watch Rob actually start to relax and change.
That must be quite rewarding, to see that response.
It really was. Like, he would just start to smile more, and he's got a great smile and a glint in his eye, you know, but I just think he felt like he's not alone anymore.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Mark Ruffalo's performance there. He's so good in this film. Like, it's such an invested performance.
It is.
And when the film ends, it's restrained,
and it simmers and it's taut, and so the moments where he breaks, the moments of outrage and the moments of exasperation, are so well earned that I felt. I mean, there were times where Mark himself, I think, confided in me and was like, "Is it enough? Is an audience going to feel rewarded and kind of gratified enough by the character?" And I just felt like that was going to be a strength, you know, that those moments would really mean something and really land. So hopefully that's the case.
I think it's like, Mark Ruffalo is a brilliant actor, but in this film, I just felt like it's such a raw performance.
Yeah.
And I was so invested. And I just wanted more when the film ended. He's really likable in the film.
Yeah.
And he's doing such a good thing, even though there's all the struggles around him. I happily sit through this for another 30, 40
That's
minutes.
So cool to hear, man, because he doesn't give you the obvious sort of gifts or rewards of you know, he doesn't solicit your likability in a way. He doesn't even smile in the movie, you know? There's one moment where he smiles at when they're toasting with Mai Tais at the hotel bar after the mediation scene in the movie. And it's so strange to what Mark, of course, has a fantastic smile and beautiful demeanor, but it was like it's so out of character almost for Rob to even crack that much sort of, you know, investment in pleasure in this film.
I thought those little bits actually where you do the Mai Tai comes back. Well, that was a nice sort of signal when he's at ease.
Yeah,
that's the visual sort of symbolizer there.
Yeah, I know. It's nice to see this character feel like he can indulge in any way in just life's pleasures, or because he's so carrying it so single-handedly.
I think that's personified in the, you know, the scenes where he feels like he's being followed. And of course, it's a giant corporation he's up against.
Yeah.
But that sort of post-traumatic stress that he shows is really affecting.
Yeah. And it was true, you know, like that again was just an example. He went to depose the CEO of DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware. And this was a major turning point in the progression of collecting discovery on the case. And he called his mother up, and she said, "Rob, does anybody know you're there?" And it just dropped like a penny. And he said, "No." You know, and he had no, and then he was alone in that parking garage when he came back out. You know, you think it's an opportunity, and it was an homage to the parking garage and all the president's men, which also came from reality. So these are all these spaces, these sort of public spaces or corporate spaces that you think about, that sort of retain your memory when you think about these kinds of movies. They're so important because they're infused with a sense of paranoia and anxiety, because the individuals who are toiling away inside of them, they're sort of inert. They don't have mobility. They're stuck, you know, and they read the implications of what they're uncovering through the confinements that they experience. And so that's why the locations, I think, are so important. But they're all real. They're true. The Taft Law Office has offered such a visual palette of sense of enclosures and entrapment, and then these sudden vista views through to, you know, downtown Cincinnati and little glimpses of the Ohio River. It was so inherently dramatic, but it was the real place.
I think they're great shapes, real life industrial shapes.
Yeah.
They work so good on a cinema screen. Especially the sort of smoking plants and you know, all that sort of, in contrast to the green fields and the farmland.
Yeah, and even those, Ed Lockman, my DP, you know, we really wanted to treat with a similar sense of something contaminating the color palette of the film, the surface of the screen, and we brought a lot of grain onto the DI process. This is the first film we've actually not shot on film.
Oh, wow.
And we fought for film. We really wanted it. It, in terms of the budget, there was a dispute about the cost of it. But so we shot it digitally, but we compensated with a lot of grain in the end in the DI. And you need it because you want to muck up the surface. And we went for this sort of cool temperature, you know. Felt more blue than we often put into the color, but I wanted to feel that the worlds in West Virginia, the rural world, and the urban world of Cincinnati, that they were linked, and you're in a continuum that where the water systems and the river systems link everybody like bloodstreams.
Absolutely, and I think that's I just assumed it was film as well because it does look like things like The Conversation and these, you know, classic paranoid thrillers.
Yeah, that's awesome when I hear that because I've had other journalists I've talked to who really are cineasts. They're like, "What? That wasn't shot on film?" So we did. I feel very proud. I told Ed that when I heard that from a French journalist who just couldn't believe it. And he was very, very happy.
Because as an audience member, you make your own sort of decisions about the film. It's like, oh, yeah, they're homaging these classic movies.
Right.
They've gone for the film and the color temperature of those.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I get it. So it's kind of nice to hear what you can do, you know, when you're, I guess you have to work with what you can work with.
Yeah. You use the tools that you have, and we did our best. But it was... But yeah, I'm glad that the ultimate effect is the one we were hoping for.
As well as Rob's story, it's actually the story of so many people.
Yeah.
Is that how did you sort of interact with the wider community who were affected by this story? Was that a concern? Like there's so many people who experienced this.
We really dealt with the people who were on the front lines of this story. Even again, in almost every case, they were unlikely people to do so, and to sort of change the way they see the world and their relationship to the parent company of Parkersburg, West Virginia, or the important sort of standing of Taft Law and reputation of Taft Law and what they risked by taking on DuPont. But so when I first traveled to Ohio and West Virginia in 2018, we met Tom Terp on Skype. We met Kim Burke, his colleague, who was also in the environmental practice group. We met Larry Winter and who is the West Virginia lead counsel. And we met Joe and Darlene Kiger, and we met Jim Tennant, who was the surviving brother of Wilbur Tennant, and he toured us, gave us a tour of the farm. We met Dr. Brooks, who organized the medical monitoring process throughout West Virginia. We met, of course, Rob's family, Sarah and the boys. So we met Kathleen, the paralegal. You know, we met every single person who was a key player in the story. And they remained accessible to us through the research process and through the shoot of the film. And that's why we got, you know, we show that a lot of these people make their appearances in the film as extras. And they were there. I just felt really important to see that these real people really were surrounding us through the film and making sure we were getting it right.
That's a really nice touch at the end. Actually, they're not just, some of them are brief, but some of them are quite major roles with lines.
Yeah.
It's quite nice to see people really wanting to be involved in this.
Yeah.
And also, actually, like, you can't tell they're not actors.
I know,
it's
right?
It's amazing.
And the other really gratifying part, and this started when I, because I shot Carol in Cincinnati.
Amazing.
Yeah, and we played Cincinnati as best we could for New York of the 1950s. But I loved the experience. I loved the place. I loved the local talent who were there. And this gave us the opportunity to come back and really exploit that and really get in even deeper with local talent. And so I couldn't have been more proud of all of our incredibly talented and amazing actors that we imported from New York and L.A. And how much they loved working with the local talent in Cincinnati, and who came from all over the Midwest. But so many of the supporting roles are people you do not see in movies, you know, and they kind of interact with our known faces and actors so seamlessly, but it gives it that real sense, I think, of truthfulness.
I think that's, yeah, it just adds to the sort of authentic experience.
Yeah. And they loved it. And the actors, the Cincinnati actors are so, they didn't seem intimidated to be working with Tim Robbins or Bill Pullman. I mean, they just seemed completely comfortable in their own skins. You know, there's some real sense of themselves and form a formidable sense of who they are. That I also just was so, I really admire. They really are that Midwest American stock, you know. It's really cool, and but really, really gifted.
I think it's brilliant to see that on screen, and it just works perfectly within the film.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today, Todd.
Thank you, it was such a pleasure.
Looking forward to opening the film in our cinemas and people seeing it on the big screen.
Yeah, me too. That means so much to all of us. Thank you so much.
Cool,
really excited.